fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
You are back in the House of Mystery, and of course, I'm Al Warren. Joining me today, we've got a horror writer called Stephen Mark Rainey. Thanks for being here, Steve.
Initially, I started writing as just Mark Rainey, but then in the town where I live here in North Carolina, there were two other Mark Raineys, two other Stephen Mark Raineys, or Stephen Raineys, I should say, and one of those Stephen Raineys lived two doors down from me, so we became the mailman's nightmare. And so I decided for writing for the long haul, I just use my full name and hopefully avoid any such errors, you know, or misidentifications.
Interesting how that goes. Did you take the other Stephen Mark Raineys and kill them off in your books?
I haven't yet, although I may have. I tell you, the one Stephen Rainey that literally lived two doors down in the same townhouse complex. And this goes back many years, but apparently he was way behind on his debts. And so I started getting all of the collection notices because, you know, he was at 3223D and I was at 3223F. So it got pretty weird there.
Yeah, I bet.
So, yeah, I'd like to avoid cases of mistakenness.
I guess. You never know what's going to come after you. So you primarily stick to horror, and it looks like ghost and sort of scary stuff. Is there a particular reason for that? Like, do you compare that to kind of real life or day-to-day life? Is there something horrific?
I have always loved scary stories, movies. I when I was a kid, I grew up in an area, rural small town, you know, with lots of woods around. And my earliest memory, the earliest emotions I remember are being afraid from the sounds that I would hear coming out of the darkness at night. We had whippoorwills that were they have kind of a mournful, eerie call, and they were all around the house at night. And about that time, this was in the early 60s, and my dad always watched like The Outer Limits and The Twilight Zone. So I associated the sounds coming out of the woods with like alien creatures, monstrous things. You couldn't convince me the little bird made those eerie noises. So my earliest recollections were of being scared. And the only thing I discovered that I liked more exhilarating, I guess you'd say, than being scared was scaring other people. So I became at a young age, I would come up with explanations and stories revolving, you know, anything in life that I could make scary, I enjoyed doing. And I think that certainly carried over in my formative years as a kid. And then growing up, I drew scary monsters, started writing scary tales. And I still love it. I just love that mode. You know,
I noticed that you took on The Dark Shadows. And Dark Shadows was kind of a classic series. Like, I remember that. I'm probably not much younger than you, but I remember being in school and pretending to be sick so I could go home and watch A Dark Shadows, because it was on at 2 and school was in until 3. So that's such sad life, eh? But it was a huge influence and stuff. And I didn't think of it as horrific, but it was suspenseful. So is that kind of how you cater your own stories?
In a lot of ways, yes. When I first started or became aware of Dark Shadows, it was because we visited my grandparents down in Georgia, and Dark Shadows aired in the afternoon there. But when my family brought us back to my home in Virginia, the local channel didn't run Dark Shadows. And so I could only, unless you had cable TV at that time, we did not have cable, but some friends of mine did. So I took every opportunity to invite myself over to their places so I could watch Dark Shadows, but it was an ongoing series, a story that just kept going and going and going, but I only got to see little bits and pieces of it. So it became this sort of special, magical property. And so by the time, I think it was in 1969, my dad got cable TV for the house. So I got to watch Dark Shadows all the time. And that just cemented in my brain that this was a wonderful show that it was kind of creepy, but it was engaging on a very mysterious level. And I've always looked at Dark Shadows as having a kind of special magic that very few other creative properties had.
Well, it was pretty amazing when you think that though it was a soap, in a sense, it really could keep your attention just with the writing, with the words, some of the characters. It's not like they had a lot of effects.
Right. The thing I can look at as an adult with Dark Shadows is when it was good, it was brilliant. I mean, the acting, the writing, the music, visuals, all these things came together to make a just a wonderful experience. Now, everybody, people tend to remember Dark Shadows for the bloopers, the gaffes, the tombstones that fall over, Barnabas Collins, stumbling over words that it's like, what the heck? But those were inevitable, I guess, because this was essentially live TV. It just happened to be videotaped. But everything that happened on the set, it was just like a live production. They couldn't afford to do retakes and such in those days. So whatever happened. And so I think for a lot of people that made it all the more endearing. As a kid, it was easy to not see those things to not register. It was all about the drama, all about that magic of the show. And to this day, it's that magic that carries over.
Yeah, I think it was fine. Considering families like yours or mine could hardly afford or get cable. The times were so different than.
Right, right.
I mean, I sort of love having those memories, but I don't look back at it badly.
It makes them more special to me to think, nowadays we can find whatever you want to watch. You can probably find it. You might have to pay a little bit for it, but so much is free. Back in those days, you got what was broadcast when it was broadcast, or if you wanted to see a horror movie or any movie, you had to wait for it to come to the theater or television. And I don't know if the younger generations quite know what that incredible anticipation was just for something like a movie. They were special.
Yeah, because they no longer have that. You don't have to be home at Friday at 7 to watch this movie or show or whatever nowadays. Nowadays it's just,
Right. Well, they're on that rare occasion that I can't find something in particular that I'm looking for, especially some older property. I'm like, what the heck? You can find anything.
Yeah.
So I sometimes get a little bit irrationally put out.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. It sure changed. But how did you get involved in doing audio, the audio production, like the scripts for them for The Dark Shadows? Like what would...
Yeah, back in 1998, Elizabeth Massey, who was a fellow writer and good friend of mine, we ended up, I think we met in the 80s at a convention, and we hit it off and had gotten together and been good friends for a long time. And she called me up one day and said HarperCollins wanted to do a new series of novels based on the original Dark Shadows. And she said, "You know more about Dark Shadows than anyone I know. Would you like to co-write a novel?" And so once she recovered from all the whooping and hollering on my end, we decided, yeah, this is a great idea. And HarperCollins accepted the novel. It was quite an adventure writing, you know, co-writing a Dark Shadows novel. And it went well. We loved it and everything. But the producers at Big Finish, who later did the Dark Shadows audio dramas, were familiar with Dreams of the Dark, which was the novel that Elizabeth Massey and I wrote, and asked if I was interested in doing some audio scripts for their or the scripts for their audio dramas. And once again, after the whooping and hollering was over with, I said, yes, of course.
How do you like writing scripts? It's a different process.
It very different from the fiction that I was accustomed to, but it wasn't that hard an adjustment. The first one I did, it was called Dark Shadows, Path of Fate. I had a little more oversight, I guess you'd say. I had to turn in outlines and sample passages, and they would say yay or nay. This is the way to do it. This is not the way to do it. But the creative process was, you know, it was storytelling. So it was just a matter of getting used to the technicalities more than anything. And working within a specific word count, you know, that would translate to the time frame of the audio drama. So the first one, Path of Fate, went out there, and it's actually it has gotten rave reviews. I'm just so gratified that within however many of these audio dramas are out there now, a couple of hundred or something like that, it's one of those that has continually gotten good notice. By the time I did the second one, which was called Curse of the Pharaoh, that dealt with a specific subplot from Dark Shadows, there was very little oversight at this point. They said, well, okay, he knows what he's doing, telling a good story. So that one went with, you know, it was just me telling the story that I wanted to tell based on the Dark Shadows property. And by the third one, they just said, have at it. And so I had at it and really love doing these. Now, this goes back a few years, and the business end of it, things got a little tense trying to get the business matters of the thing settled. So I had a lot of other irons in the fire. So I did not, once I got past that third one, I moved on to other things. But I tell you, if I do get the opportunity to go back and write Dark Shadows, it would be high up on my list of things to do.
Yeah, I think it's due. So I'll get the word out there. I'll get it going.
Oh, how awesome.
I love it. That would be great. I think so. But, you know, they don't always listen to me. So, and you moved on to America Scares with Elizabeth Massey as well. And now, if you have kind of a ghost and paranormal sort of side to you that, you know, that you like to write about?
That's an interesting thing to try to answer, because I am a diehard skeptic. I don't believe in necessarily paranormal phenomenon or anything. I believe, you know, I think there might be preternatural things that are basically unexplained. They just, they happened, but at the same time, from the standpoint of exploring those in fiction, those are the things that grip me, that the hypotheticals, the what if. And the Ameriscares series, of course, it's for younger readers, you know, middle grade readers. And the allure of that, when Elizabeth Massey asked me if I were interested in contributing, was my first thought was, talk about the perfect project to sort of get in touch with your inner child. And my inner child is one dominating son of a bitch, I can tell you. I mean, let's see, what have I done? I've done 5, I think, so far, and we'll probably continue to do a few more. But for anyone who is not aware of the property, it's Ameriscares is a series of novels for young readers, say ages 8 to 14 or so. Each book is set in one of the 50 states, so that at the end of it all, there's going to be like 50 books, each one based in the folklore or myths or legends of each state. And the first one I did was called West Virginia Lair of the Mothman. And it, you know, it's about the Mothman from West Virginia. And then I've done several more. I just finished the Georgia book. It hasn't been published yet, but it's about Lake Lanier in Georgia, which is reputedly haunted. And my grandparents lived along Lake Lanier. So that was a special personal interest to me. So yeah, I've really enjoyed exploring supernatural, preternatural things on a level that I think will both, in, you know, hopefully sort of creep out kids, but also engage them, enthrall.
You find it a challenge, but to write about something you don't necessarily believe in?
Yes and no. On a practical level, it's, you know, it's writing. You know, I have the technicalities of writing down pretty good. I'm comfortable with them. On the emotional or intuitive level, I have that backdrop of growing up with fear of the unknown. And it's so easy for me to still draw on those feelings. And I mean, I've read, Lord knows how many scary books I've read in my lifetime, probably way too many. I've got influences up to here. So it's so natural for me to do this. So I would say there's the only challenge of it is to keep coming up with something, if not new and fresh, something that is alluring, something that's going to grab readers, that doesn't feel like it's been done over and over and over again. That's the challenge of it, is to make something novel in its approach.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea to get into the paranormal, but I just wonder because if you were kind of doubting a lot of it, you know, if it would be a challenge to you to write down, you'd kind of go more like after the, not so much doing it, but after you finished, you'd kind of go,
Now there's a point, because one of the things I can't bring myself to do is read something I've already written. Not usually. I mean, a lot of times I have to go back in and, you know, edit. And if I'm collecting older stories, such as the book that's just come out, like this Fugue Devil Resurgence is my latest book. So I had to revisit some of my older stories. But going back and rereading my older work, or even something I wrote last week, I hesitate to say that I automatically don't like it, but I tend to automatically not like it. because I'm already, you know, my brain is moving on to whatever the next thing is that I want to do. And sometimes to more address your point, I will look back at stuff I've written and I think, does that work? Is it, at the time I thought it worked, but I read it now and I think, did I go far enough? Did I go too far? I second guess myself on everything. So it's just a hell of a lot better if I don't go back and revisit.
I think that's natural, because I do that with myself. And once it's published, I'm out the door. And when people start talking about it or they want to bring it back, I'm like, oh, I have the same urge not to go back and look at stuff.
Now this is no doubt a sidetrack, and I'm notorious for sidetracking, but you know, when I listened to the Dark Shadows audio dramas that I had written, the actors, you know, who came from Dark Shadows, you know, the actors that I practically worshiped as a youngster, they're reading the lines that I wrote, and I am alternately thrilled and mortified, because everything they read just seemed to highlight what I thought at the time were the inadequacies of what I was doing. I thought, did I really write that? That's horrible. And it's me, a performer, you know. But I will say, on the flip side of that, like at the end of Path of Fate, my first of the audio dramas, Laura Parker, who played Angelique, and who, you know, when I was 10 years old, she was the first woman I ever fell in love with. And now she's performing a part or lines for, you know, for this drama that I wrote. I literally forgot that I wrote it. I'm listening to it and I'm thinking, she's so good. She elevated what I did. I wish I had more experiences that I could say my work was elevated, because usually it's just me looking at it and going, oh my God, what have I done?
But I think that's the whole thing. Isn't that something that most authors go through, you know, like that, you know, that syndrome there where we think it's kind of like it's fake, it's not real, you know, I think,
yeah.
Know that I hear that a lot, and I understand it, because I feel I relate to a lot of this, especially the going back and feeling, you know, like that imposter syndrome. And and I said, so, you know, because other people like it, they take it somewhere and they enjoy it, and I think that's all that matters, you know.
I think you're quite right. Yeah.
So now your new one, and I see this Fugue Devil. So you've taken some of the old short stories and you've also put new ones in there. Is there something about a short story you like better than, let's say, a full book?
I've always appreciated short fiction from a reader's standpoint. So, amongst my favorite reading matter, coming up in horror as a reader, I think so much of what I read was short fiction, going back to when I was in probably as far back as elementary school. But I would read anthologies, you know, that I don't know if you'd remember them, but there were these Alfred Hitchcock books.
I was just going to say that.
Like stories to read at late at night, you know, or Alfred Hitchcock's Monster Museum. So many of the most memorable monster stories, horror, things that moved me, things that touched me, were short fiction. And in college, I read H.P. Lovecraft, a friend of, you know, so many people that my peers read H.P. Lovecraft as kids, but I did not. I was a friend of mine in college had a bunch of those old Lovecraft paperbacks. And he said, this looks like stuff you would like. So I started reading them one night. I lived out in the sticks. And ordinarily there were four other people lived in the house, but at this time I was alone. And for the first time since I was a little kid, I couldn't go to sleep. I was like, holy crap, this stuff is scary. So as a writer, I think I naturally gravitated toward short fiction. Of course, and I love a lot of horror novels as well, but there's something about the construction of a story that sets up the necessary elements of the drama, of the characters, the setting. An awful lot of times it doesn't need to be carried out to full novel length. Plenty does, but I think that short form is just so appropriate to the emotion of horror.
Yeah, it's something I like still. Like when you mentioned Alfred Hitchcock, some of the short ones and Twilight Zone and all of that. I think it gets to the point and you don't have to get into a lot of the characters' drama. You know, you don't have to get too deep into them.
Conversely, when I'm not reading scary things, I read a lot of nonfiction, and I love novels that aren't necessarily scary. You know, my favorite novel series outside of the scary field were the James Bond novels, not horror. I still love that stuff. But yeah, the short form for horror it really does have an allure for me. So I've written several novels, I've enjoyed them, but I think for the impact, the sense of immediacy in a short story to me really does.
Do you like to create a story around? Is it like a question? Or is it around a character? Like, you know, so do you have like some sort of question, like, you know, if the world was this, or if, you know, where everyone looked a certain way and someone was different, or do you go to a character and base your story around a character? What's your favorite, or do you have one?
All of the above, but you know, what really sets my mind in motion is setting, places that I've been or that I want to experience. For example, I'm at right up to the moment that we started this interview. I'm plotting a new novel that's set in Italy. Back in, let's say, after my wife and I have taken a couple of trips to Italy with friends, and we discovered so many incredible places, and it's the places that set my mind in motion to that makes me feel a connection and really gets the creative energy going. And Another thing about setting is that one of my activities outside of writing is geocaching. I don't know if you even know what geocaching is. It's sort of a high-tech treasure hunt where people geocachers we're called, there are hidden containers out in the wild. They're everywhere. There are, I think, something to the effect of 3 million geocaches out in the world. A person hides something, a small container, something with swag in it, but they all have a log sheet in them so that when you find them, you sign it to show that you've been there. And when a person hides one, the coordinates, the GPS coordinates are published on the website, and finders go out there and try to find it. Geocaching has taken me to some of the most incredible locations I have ever seen. And so many of them close to home or when we're traveling, like when we were traveling in Italy or Spain or France, one of the first things I wanted to do was go out there and go geocaching. And I would find the coolest places I've ever seen in my life. And that gets that creative energy going. So a lot of times, setting is what fires me up to get a story in the works.
So in a way, I guess you probably write your location as a character.
Very much so. And that's something that as a reader resonates with me. When a writer uses setting in such a way that it draws me in the same way that that characters would. And conversely, if a writer fails at convincing me of the location, that's definitely points against. There was I'm not going to pinpoint the who's and the where's or anything, but there was one novel back in the 90s that was supposed to be set in Chicago. Now, I lived in Chicago for a lot of years. There was nothing in that book, not one word in that book, that made me think, oh yeah, Chicago. And it just pulled me right out of that book. On the upside of that, another writer I know, Wayne Allen Sully, is a native of Chicago. And so many of his stories are set in Chicago that even if you've never been to that city, I don't see how you could mistake his prose for taking place anywhere else. He paints that setting with such vividness and such beauty, no matter how depraved it might be. There's a beauty in that language, in putting you within a context. And so that is an aspiration of mine, to make the setting a character.
I think that's great. That's really good. Do you also have some sort of subtext or point behind your stories, or is it just purely entertainment?
I like to think that some of the stuff I've written goes well beyond simple entertainment, and whether I succeed at that is not for me to say. There are a number of my stories that, in varying degrees of actual fact, tell of people and things, feelings and attitudes that I couch in the world of fiction. But yeah, they are saying things that I feel important. Sometimes I disguise those aspects to the point that I don't know if anyone beyond me as the writer, I don't know if anyone out there is going to get it. But if my feeling is, if they do, then we're on the same page, and I love that. The key is that they don't get that. They still need to be entertained. I don't want to lose anybody. But yeah, I do have a number of works that I think they're saying something that I had to say, that I had to put out there, and I hope people get it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you don't get it, I hope it doesn't put you off.
Well, I think, and I would imagine sometimes, it would happen organically. It would just happen without you pre-planning.
Oh, yes. Yeah. It's rare that I go into something with, I guess what you'd say, an agenda, yeah, or
intention.
Yeah. Or a deeper purpose. Yeah. I think they do. They just happen in it. And once I get going with it, I realize, yeah, I have to do this, whatever that this is. Yeah, I have to do it.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept. Well, I think one of the things I noticed was, okay, Richard Chismar, who's been on the show, he's a nice guy, I like him. Mm-hmm. He gives you a good review of this book. How does that make you feel?
Well, I love it. I mean, Rich and I go back to the earliest days of, I think, both of us as creators. He started a little magazine called Cemetery Dance that grew into this fairly massive property in the horror field. And I did, I had a magazine called Death Room that we were contemporaries. He and I used to write letters back in the days before email or anything like that. We shot letters back and forth all the time. And much to my shame, there were times that I could be so freaking critical of stuff because I knew what I liked and I liked what I knew. So, you know, sometimes, you know, Rich would publish something and I'd go, "What the hell are you thinking, man?" And he would do the same. And but over the years, I think Rich took a path that I admire. I absolutely admire what he did. My circumstances were that, you know, I would have loved to have gone that way, but it just couldn't happen. But the fact that over the years, you know, I don't see him regularly, but when I do, it's kind of like a nice reunion, you know? So when somebody of Rich's stature who knows something of me, where I came from and what I do, if he has good things to say, then that makes me stand up and go, "Thank you." You know, that touches me. It means something to me because I know he's not, you know, he's not just spewing crap. He is a man of integrity, and that means a lot to me.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I think it's wonderful when someone comes out. Do you interact with a lot of people online and readers, and are you into all the social media thing in the current world?
I as far as social media goes, I mostly deal with Facebook. I've never found any allure to Twitter. So I once in a while I've got a Twitter account and I'll post something up there. I interact with a good many people on Facebook once in a while. If I've got a new book or product or something, I'll go to town and, you know, do some promotion and stuff. But I try to, as far as social media goes, I try to keep it more informal. Just, you know, it's more me and friends and people interacting. There's a lot of geocaching stuff out there. If one wanted to know how to market on social media, don't look at me.
don't.
I do not feel like I do marketing well. That of all the things I do as a writer, marketing and selling myself is probably the least of them. I freaking hate it. I don't do it well. I don't know how to do it. So I just try to interact with people on in the way I do it, and hopefully that as a person, you know, you're not going to say, "Well, you're awful. I'm not going to buy your stuff. You're awful. I'm not going to interact with you." Whatever. I try not to go that way.
Well, you know, I think it's not necessarily a natural thing, especially for a writer.
No, to me, it is not.
I mean, and you're writing.
It's like me and math. Math and I are not good friends, and I would say that it's that marketing and I are not good friends. We suck.
Well, like I said, it's not a natural thing. You're focusing on writing and doing stories and things like that. So that's not, exactly, you know, exactly. That's not. Now, characters, how do you create your characters or get your characters? Is this total imagination, or is it something you pick up by, you know, you're out at a coffee shop, or you're out in the mall looking at people, or it's a...
Yeah. Both my wife and I have always been, she's not a writer or anything. She's more of an artist, but we like people watching. Wherever we are, we like to sit at wine bars and drink wine and look around, and without necessarily eavesdropping, if we can pick up on mannerisms, on the way people comport themselves with other people, everything goes into this catalog, this little file cabinet that I have inside. And I'm like, I can use that. Yes, I can use that. And then there are you know, friends, people of my acquaintance that stand out traits I tend to store in my memory banks. And a lot of times I will weave a character that I can go back to those files and go, okay, these traits work, these traits over here work, that dialogue works over here, and then try to compose people that are both believable and in some fashion relatable. I was about to say a lot of antagonists. I don't like to paint antagonists as just bad people, bad forces, whatever. The key, I think, to antagonists is whether, or even anti-heroes, whatever, is to make people that they don't necessarily have to be likable, but in some fashion, you want to relate. You don't want them to just, well, with it, with certain dramatic exceptions, you don't want them to be ciphers. You don't want them to have no depth. And so, yes, whether it be protagonists, antagonists, whoever, I try to draw characters both from experience and from projection to take the characteristics that I have recorded and to weave them into someone that you're actually going to care about, whether positively or negatively.
Do you experience characters in any particular way? And I say that because a lot of fiction writers will say that they hear them or they see them, you know, I hear all sorts of stories. They relate to them like family, like kids. Like, do you have any of that, or do you just sort of?
Sometimes, yeah. And you've probably heard this before. Actors, characters in roles, you know, I can look at, say, the main character of my novel, Blue Devil Island, who is a pilot. I can think, that's a young William Holden. Or I can think of a guy in one of my others and go, oh, that's Roy Scheider. You know, and I will see actors playing roles, and it's very easy to plug them into the character that I'm painting. That's not ubiquitous. That doesn't happen all the time, but sometimes. But that's one way that they resonate.
Interesting. So now this Fugue Devil, 30th anniversary. Was there a particular reason you resurfaced, like resurged this?
That was actually not my idea, but I liked the idea. There's a little backstory here that a few years back. I mentioned before growing up in a little town in Virginia, Martinsville, Virginia. I still own my childhood home. It was, you know, after my mom died, it was willed to me. So I still spend a lot. It's about an hour from here. I spend a lot of time there. I love going there. A few years back, Samara Wynn, who was a Facebook friend, you know, and the last I knew, she lived in California. And suddenly I saw she was posting from Martinsville, Virginia. And I'm like, that, what? You know, that's too weird. So as it turns out, she had moved to Martinsville almost by chance with her ex-husband. They move literally as the crow flies, a stone's throw from my old childhood home. And we started getting together, my wife, and we'd sit out and drink wine and talk writing and fiction and everything about the business. And she has been publishing her own fiction under her own label for several years and doing extremely well with it. And she wanted to branch out into publishing other writers, and she had gotten to the point where she, you know, she felt like I've got some work that would be viable, commercially viable, that she particularly liked. And she said, how would you like to do a collection of your fiction? And here it is, it's going on 30 years since this story, Fugue Devil, which I feel like is one of the most pivotal works, most perfectly, personally meaningful works that I did. She goes, 30 year anniversary. How would you like to have a fiction collection with that story and whatever you want to put around it? And I thought, how could I say no to that? So we started brainstorming, and I started looking at my body of work and thought, what would be appropriate to surround that story as a centerpiece? Here it is, exactly 30 years after it first came out. And so it just sort of was an organic thing. It started growing, and collaboratively we put together this collection, and now it exists. And I really do feel like it's probably the single most representative work or collection of my fiction, my short fiction. The paperback and ebook versions are available right now. The hardback version has had a slight delay, but should be out very, very shortly. But that's kind of how that came about. It was, from my perspective, unexpected and very serendipitous, I suppose.
It's like their greatest hits collection.
You could say that. I guess you could say that, because I don't know if I'm the world's best person to choose greatest hits or anything like that. But I feel like I'm very pleased with the selection of stories in there. And you had asked earlier about, you know, the themes, the underlying motivation for certain stories. And I feel like the ones that have what I felt I needed to say, I think I managed to get them in there. It's probably this is my sixth collection of short fiction. And I feel like, for me personally, it's the most important.
Well, and I think it's great. Do you have a favorite story in there? I know if it's kind of like your best of, in a sense, or it's kind of the ones you appreciate most, as well as new ones. Is there a favorite one of all of these?
I don't know if I can narrow it down to one. There are three stories that are what I would call, as a writer, pivotal. Fugue Devil, the title story, is number one in that it was the hardest story for me to come up with a vehicle for. It was based on a true night horror, a night terror that I had as a teenager that truly traumatized me. I think I was probably somewhere between 12 and 14 when it happened. It featured this entity, this horrific creature that I think in my brain was a combination of some of the scariest images that ever came to me from, like, the old horror movies and such. But the dream itself woke me on three occasions. I would have this appearance of this thing, this creature, and I'd wake up in a cold sweat. It was an experience like nothing I'd ever had. I mean, truly woke up sweating and freezing. I'd go back to sleep and the dream would take up exactly where it left off. The creature would appear again and the same thing would happen. This happened three times. And I remember every image from that dream. This minute, that would have been in, you know, 50 plus years ago, but I remember it more clearly than any waking memory or most waking memories from those days. And it took me years and years and years to come up with a story, something that I could wrap around those moments of trauma. But I was determined that I have to present this story, because it was so pivotal in my development. So Fugue Devil, I would say yes, is number one. There's a second story called Somewhere My Love, with, you know, like the song title, and it's based on the song title, that is the autobiography that never actually happened. It's a story about a young music student and his music teacher and a mutual love of music and ostensibly dark things that happen, but it's kind of a love story. None of the events in that story actually happened to me as a kid, but I wrote them with the emotions that I felt as a kid. And I just sort of twisted them. I distorted them a little bit. And I've read that story aloud on a number of occasions, one of them being at work where I used to work, which was all former teachers. And at the end of reading this aloud, there was not a dry eye in the audience. And I thought, okay, this is the story, that this did it. And also, as an aside, that story was originally published in Orson Scott Card's Intergalactic Medicine Show. And Scott Card read that and posted it on his on that magazine website, on the Intergalactic Show website. And it was the most wonderful reading ever. I listened to it again, as I had mentioned with the Dark Shadows thing. It was like, I didn't even know I wrote this. It was mesmerizing to hear someone else tell this story. And thirdly and finally, there's a story called Night Crier. My mom suffered from dementia, and I was her caretaker for several years, and it was the hardest experience I've ever lived through. And she died in 2020. But before she died, I wrote this story that was inspired entirely by my experience with her dementia. And it's the dark flip side to Somewhere My Love. It's the autobiography that never happened. But instead of being heartwarming, it's the exact opposite, inspired by that experience with my mom. So those, to answer your question, there's three stories. I couldn't pinpoint it to one, but those three are the ones that had to be there. They're the ones that, those are the stories I had to tell.
Yeah, no, that's great. It's always good to hear. Wow. Now, do you have a website and something like that where people can find you, or?
I do. My website, which is older than the hills, I marginally updated. It's just my full name, StephenMarkRainey.com, StephenMarkRainey. And that does have links to my Facebook, where I'm pretty active. I've got a blog where I do anything and everything related to writing. I put on the blog. I put a lot of geocaching stuff in there. There's a lot of stuff that's basically just for me, but I try to make it entertaining. If you happen to stumble upon this thing, you poor sod. But there's links to all of those on my site.
Of course, we'll have that up so people can find you easy with one click. Anybody listening, you know, how was the COVID for you in your writing? Like, did it kind of get in the way for you? It's a lot of writers that, you know, I had two kind of response. I had writers, some that would say that it shut them down, and other writers that would say it kind of enhanced them.
It did shut me down to some extent. I was hoping for the exact opposite effect, but it really didn't. Real life issues truly crowded out not just the time and energy available, but the spark. That moves me to write was crowded out by real life concerns, things that had to be done. But after the worst of it, and like I said, I've just been suffering with about a COVID myself, which fortunately was virtually negligible. But there was an anthology that has been put together, hasn't been released yet, based entirely on COVID experiences put into the realm okay, I'll tell you what, let me not go into that background because that might be a spoiler. The editor doesn't want me to spoil. So let's just say, yes, there is a new anthology coming out that is stories inspired by COVID experiences. And so I did contribute to that. That's fairly recent. And like I said, I'm not sure I'm supposed to be talking about it in public. So I won't give it more than that.
Well, it's all good. It's all good. People will love it no matter what. So now the book, of course, we're talking about is Fugue Devil, Resurgence. Yes. Our guest is the author, and we appreciate you being here. So that's Stephen Mark Rainey. Thank you.
Thank you. This has been a real pleasure.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.